Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3.
Hello and welcome to Wireless, a new series all about radio broadcast on the first Monday of every month on Flirt FM 101.3. Wireless aims to cover all aspects of radio, analogue and digital broadcasting, community, regional and national stations, niche broadcasting, pirate and alternative radio, podcasting, questions of ownership and diversity, and aspects of radio's past, present and future. We'll be featuring interviews with people involved in radio in Ireland and abroad, news about the radio landscape, and features about stations and sectors, including public, commercial and community broadcasters. I'm John Walsh, and I've been involved in radio for 30 years since I was a teenager in Dublin in the 1980s. Dublin then was buzzing with the excitement of pirate radio, and I did my fair share of broadcasting from garden sheds and community halls. I went on to make a career out of broadcasting for the best part of 10 years, and although I left the media formally in the late 1990s, I never lost my love for the medium of radio, and I hope to share that passion with you during this series. Radio was the social media of my youth. We downloaded music from our favourite radio stations onto cassettes and saved our pennies for vinyl. We liked and shared, but not in the same way. Then we set up our own radio station during the school holidays 30 years ago this year, and more about that later. Each JNLR survey claims that radio remains hugely popular in Ireland, but many of us fear that its star is fading due to competition from social media, music downloads and streaming services. What future does radio have in the age of Spotify and iTunes? How will it hold its own when music is so cheaply and easily available from other sources? Is it all about the music or something else? These are just some of the questions we'll be discussing on Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3 over the coming months.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
Coming up on this edition of Wireless, we talk to veteran broadcaster Brendan Balfe about the forthcoming event A Century of Radio on Culture Night. We preview positive mental health station Walk in My Shoes Radio. We look back at a radio reunion in Dublin after 30 years. And we interviewed Pat Herbert, founder of the Hurdy Gurdy Museum of Vintage Radio in Howth. The Broadcasting Authority of Ireland will hold a special evening celebrating the development of radio in Ireland as part of Culture Night 2016, which will take place on Friday the 16th of September. Visitors to the BAI building in Dublin will be able to explore a free exhibition marking the centenary of the first broadcast in Ireland in 1916 and the 90th anniversary of the establishment of the country's first radio service, 2RN. The exhibition will include storyboard and listening points, offering a variety of audio clips recorded over the last century. A selection of radio equipment from the Hurdy Gurdy Museum of Vintage Radio will also be on display for the evening. In order to ensure a diverse and engaging audio experience for visitors, the BAI has invited radio stations across the country to submit interesting audio clips and archive material. As part of the event, radio personality and historian Brendan Balfe will present two short talks focusing on the history of Irish radio. And Brendan joins us on the phone now. Brendan, you're very welcome to the first edition of Wireless.
Thank you very much, John.
So you'll be giving two talks at the event, Ireland Calling and Clips on the Ear. Can you give us a brief flavour of what you'll be covering in each?
Well, Ireland Calling is sort of the history of Irish radio. Ireland Calling was one of the possible call signs that Radio Éireann were about to use before they called it Radio Éireann, so it fits the talk very well. So it comes from 1916. In 1916, the first broadcast is the one that the volunteers in the GPO sent out. Actually, it came from, not the GPO, as you well know, it came from the Dublin Wireless Telegraphy School across the road in Abbey Street. But it's also, it was called a broadcast because it was not directed at anybody in particular. Yeah. At first, it was Morse code. I think it's rather shaky, but it's sort of accepted. It's sort of one of the myths of 1916. You can blame Marshall McLuhan for it. He was the one in a book in the 60s said this is the first broadcast. It's sort of the first broadcast.
Very good. And this and the talk on clips on the ear.
Just,
then
just favourite bits and pieces that I've loved over the years, and I've put into the talk, including a couple of bloopers, a couple of news pieces that shouldn't have gone out but did, and sort of a few sponsored program clips that never got heard but should be. People when they're recording things, there's a sort of a heightened sense of the ridiculous, and sort of the brain goes, did I really read that, or did I really say that? So there's a sort of a giggling thing happens. So I've got a few things of Larry Gold and Chris Curran and various people breaking down halfway through. So they're the sort of clips. And a few, if you like, historical ones. That you asked me, what sort of clips? Things like maybe Debs' reply to Churchill, maybe the opening of Telefy Sharon, which was covered better on radio than it was on television. Mm-hmm. And the one that my favourite clip of all time, which I've sort of put it into most of those documentary sort of social history programmes I've done. I've got a few minutes to squeeze it. It's the coming of rock and roll to Dublin in 1956, which was in the Carlton Cinema, which strangely enough was the very first rock and roll riot in Europe, because Rock Around the Clock, the movie, came to Ireland before it came to London. So we got the first shot at it, and there were teddy boys ripping up seats. I think three or four seats, and maybe three or four teddy boys. But that's all it was. So it became a sort of a riot, but it was a piece by Kevin O'Kelly. Excuse me. And it was just a perfect 3-minute radio package. He had a little bit of narration. He had an interview with the manager. He had people dancing in the Crystal Ballroom and dancers who were doing rock and roll. And he more or less said, this rock and roll craze, I think it'll catch on. I said, we'll catch on and catch on fast. And the man was right. So that's my favourite clip.
Okay, so the big dates we know well over the last century, with the establishment of 2RN and Radio Éireann and going on to Radio na Gaeltacht, the Radio 2 and so on. But do you have a personal highlight from the last 100 years of broadcasting that mightn't be as well known?
I like a few of them. I did a lot of them on the programme. Actually, they turned up on the CD I did of the Irish Voice series, things that I liked. I liked things, for instance, the opening of Telefy Sharon, because it actually is very, very descriptive. It's Ernest Byrne. He recorded in the main control room on the opening night, and he's cueing the National Anthem film, and he's just talking over it and says, standing by camera, move camera, so and so, blah, blah, blah. And it goes into the Devil Era speech about television, which he looked down on, apparently, with a great degree of ambivalence, not to say indifference, I have to say. But nonetheless, I like that clip. So it's a very good piece of radio.
And finally, we know the pressure that radio is under from social media and streaming services. What do you think, what does the future hold for the medium?
I have no idea. All I can say is that radio is a companionable thing. It's a communication process for, and we always have to remember, it's a process towards one person. It is you're talking to a single listener all the time. They may be listening in thousands, but they're listening in single ones. Rarely do people gather around the radio set anymore more to hear Michael O'Hare doing the All Ireland broadcast, and I think that's there's a certain degree of I think grace and humour and brightness and intelligence in radio, which you will not get in the other media, in the sense that there's still a place for professional broadcasting people, broadcasting programmes, well thought out, well documented, well described, and put together with a great deal of love and integrity. I think that will always be there. I don't think the social media will take over. They're quicker and faster, but they ain't as deep.
Brendan, thank you very much for joining us on
You're
Wireless
welcome,
today.
John.
A Century of Radio will run from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. at the BAI headquarters at 2-5 Warrington Place in Dublin 2. No pre-booking is necessary for the general events, but tickets are required for Brendan's talks, although there is no entry charge. Further information is available at bai.ie and culturenight.ie. Walk in My Shoes Radio will be back on the air from the 1st to the 14th of October. It will broadcast from St Patrick's Mental Health Services in Dublin for Mental Health Week and live from World Mental Health Day on October the 10th until the 14th. The pop-up radio will be available on FM as a multi-city licence, similar to Christmas FM, which broadcasts from 9 sites around Ireland, including Galway. The station will also be streaming online and on DAB where available, although, of course, this doesn't include Galway. Programming is by professional broadcasters volunteering for the station in their free time. The mix will be 50% talk and 50% upbeat music. The message of the station is positive mental health with a recovery message. This will be St Patrick's fourth pop-up broadcast since October 2014. Transmission and studio fit-out is provided by Broadcast Technical Services. Frequencies are still being planned, so visit walkinmyshoes.ie/radio for more details. The RDS display will be WIMS-FM and the service will be testing from the eve of October the 1st. And we'd like to wish Walk in My Shoes Radio every success this year, and we hope to feature the station in the next programme. Kinvara FM is a new radio station being developed in South County Galway. The community station had a live broadcast on August 20th and 21st during the annual Cringoon na Maith Festival. Despite its name, the station was not on FM on this occasion, but instead broadcast on its website, kinvarafm.com, and on its Facebook page. The plan is to apply for an FM licence in the future. News about a radio reunion after 30 years in Dublin, where I began my journey in radio broadcasting. In June 1986, at the height of the pirate era in Ireland, six teenagers set up their own station, Big Beat Radio, from a community hall in Baldoyle in Dublin 13. I knew one of the founders, Brian Green, from school and joined Big Beat as its newsreader. We broadcast in bad quality sound on low power FM for 7 weeks that summer, but it was the buzz and the music that mattered, and for many of us, it launched a lifetime love of radio. Last month, Big Beat returned for a 30-year reunion and broadcast for 8 days online and on the TuneIn app. I presented a retro news bulletin based on the actual news of August the 7th, 1986. And by the way, the headline that day was that the then DUP deputy leader Peter Robinson had marched across the border with hundreds of loyalists to Clontibret in County Monaghan. Here's an extract from a discussion about the background to Big Beat between three of the founders, Brian Green, Donal Green and Peter Walsh.
Baldoyle had three radio stations in 1986.
Yeah, and it's bizarre actually, isn't
Skywave
it?
Yeah. And Big Beat and Radio Valerie.
Yeah.
Two internationals on the shortwave and one little FM down in the community hall. The question has come up before. Who in their right mind would let six 16-year-olds rent a room in a community hall with no form of income and to run an illegal pirate radio station?
They did it. And
they did it, yeah. And I think it was very positive. I mean, there was a good reaction from Ren. I mean, it wasn't hugely popular, but I mean, people were curious about it and, we made use of a space that nobody else was using and nobody was going to use. I mean, it was at the back of the hall. It was terribly well looked at.
It needed a lick of paint, which we did tidy up a lot,
you know. But I remember, at one stage I was doing the breakfast show and you get down there like early in the morning, whatever time it was. I mean, it was just, it reeked of damp, you know, and you'd have to throw open the doors and try and let some fresh air into the place before you'd start, you know. So, you know, but I mean, they did give it to us. I mean, credit to them for that. But I don't know how we swung it. I mean, who did we approach? I don't remember who we went to.
We went to a meeting. I remember being in a meeting with some, they were older people. They're probably our age now.
Yeah.
And they let us in. But I'm thinking, did we ever pay the rent?
And it was great. I mean, it was a real novelty at the time. I mean, it was pretty bold for kids our age to be thinking to do something like that and then actually carrying it out, you know?
Yeah, me and John Walsh have unearthed some sounds now. I haven't got them queued up and ready to play at you or anything, but sound quality was abysmal.
Yeah. I remember the big difference between the two record decks. I mean, you could tell which deck was being played, you know? I mean, one was better than the other, clearly better, you know?
And something like triangular.
Yeah.
Looked like a big Toberon.
I think we got that from there, didn't we?
We did. We're in...
Probably ran on valves. It buzzed like mental.
We were in 2016. We are in 2016, and we're talking about 30 years ago. We were using something in 1986 that was probably built in the 1960s. And it was an amplifier. It was a 45-degree chamfered kind of angled mixer amplifier. It had a couple of faders on it. So we were using the mixing part and not the amplification part. Mm. And do you remember the microphone?
I do, yeah. What it was just a stick or something with a microphone sellotape on it or something.
There is a photograph of you on air, so we will unearth that, and it's on a kind of a banister's dowel, and the end is square end, and it's under the strap of the mixer.
Yeah, that's right.
Microphone is covered in some cloth for some kind of
pop shield or something.
Yeah, yeah. We've pop shields on these, and they're just, you know, they're, everything is. We did so much with so little.
That's Brian Green ending that extract from the Big Beat Radio reunion last month, complete with some sound problems on one of the microphones, just to be authentic to the original station. Broadcasts from the reunion and the original close down from 1986 are available on Mixcloud. Just search for We Are Big Beat Radio. And finally, in international news, according to the website RadioWorld.com, New York City is experiencing an upsurge in pirate radio activity, with a total of 76 unlicensed stations detected in a recent engineering survey commissioned by the New York State Broadcasters Association. According to the survey, there are 19 unauthorized stations in the Bronx, 29 in Brooklyn, 13 in Newark, New Jersey, and 15 in Paterson, New Jersey. Brooklyn saw a 58% increase in the number of pirate stations compared to a similar survey conducted in 2015. This year's survey observes that it has probably underestimated the number of pirate stations in the area and that the total could be more than 100.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
Radio as a form of magic, a hidden spirit, a theatre of the mind. Those are some of the words used by my next guest to describe his love of the medium. Pat Herbert was born in Mayo in the 1930s and spent his life collecting radios, gramophones and other radio-related paraphernalia. In 2003, Fingal County Council offered the recently refurbished Martello Tower in Howth in North Dublin to Pat to use as a museum, and thus was born the Hurdy Gurdy Museum of Vintage Radio. For Pat, the museum is a labour of love, not a money-making venture, and it is staffed by himself and a team of volunteers. I met Pat in Dublin recently and first asked him about his earliest memory of radio, the famous broadcast of the All-Ireland football final from New York on Radio Éireann in 1947.
Well, it goes back a long way back to test my early memory. I was a young boy at the time in the west of Ireland in Mayo, and we didn't have such thing as a radio or wireless in the village. So word spread around the village that neighbours of ours were getting a wireless. And my parents, having returned from America some years earlier, were referring to it as a radio because they had experiences in America. But in any case, news spread, as I said, to all the adjoining villages. And on the night in question, it was in September, I believe, and the house was crowded. Well, by the time we got there as youngsters, the house was full. So we had to make do with standing up in the front garden or sitting down on the ground or whatever. And the windows were open. And this magic box was inside on the windowsill. And picking up the commentary of the broadcasts all the way from the Polo Grounds in New York. And I was kind of mystified because the nearest wires were 3 miles away in Crossmolina. And I couldn't understand how this could come all the way into a little village from a few thousand miles away without any wires. And I was mystified by it all, and I still am. As I say, it was Micheál O'Hare anyway. I remember it like yesterday, Cabin and Kerry. And that was my first experience of radio, and it got me hooked on radio. A few years later, I immigrated to London, and I worked there in a hotel, and I had my own radio in my room. And I would fiddle around all night with the dial, picking up stations all around Europe. I realised for the first time there was different types of music, there was different languages, there was different stations all around Europe speaking different languages. So it was an education in a sense.
And why did it make such a difference to you back in Mayo in 1947? What was so special about the broadcast for you? What changed your view as a result of it?
Well, what interested me more than anything was the lighting, believe it or not. It was the first time I saw artificial light. Before that, we just had a candle or an oil, a little oil lamp, because you have to imagine that oil was rationed during the war. Mm-hmm. And of course there was no electricity in rural Ireland. And what amazed me most of all was the artificial light. It lit up the dial of the radio. And this seemed a magic box in some sense, sitting in the corner talking, an actual box talking. And you must realise, even for people much older than me at the time, it was a form of magic, or a hidden spirit, if you like electricity was later. It was hidden, you couldn't see it, and yet it was coming into the back of the radio, and this man a few thousand miles away was talking out the front of the radio. So it was a magic, and it still is a bit of magic.
And when you went to London then, would you have been listening to Radio Éireann then in London?
Yes, and it was difficult, because Radio Éireann, it came in squeaks and pips and whatever, and most times we would assemble on a Sunday to listen to the match, and mostly in where we stayed in Perham Road in Kensington. And we'd have to take the radio on the balcony. There'd be a balcony window up high on the house. And we'd have to take the radio and the wires out onto the balcony and then relay the scores or the results or whatever in through the window to the people inside. So from down in Mayo in 47, to be outside listening to the radio, we were inside listening to it out from the radio outside.
And would you have relied then, when you were in London, on Radio Éireann then for news from home? Would that have been an important source for you?
Absolutely, that was. That was the message from home, you know. On the Sunday, the match meant everything. The GAA meant everything. It's ironic now that the modern GAA has sold out on that. In later years, we were involved, and I was involved with many others, in the starting up of clubs, and particularly in Bristol down the West Country, and where we affiliated there, the GAA started up a club and organised it and whatever, and that's forgotten now with the GAA, with my generation, because they're kind of left behind. Everything has gone to Sky. And on Saturday last, I was back to where I was in 47, and now it's 2016. Where I had to, as we said at the time, we saw the match on the radio. Well, I had to see the match on the radio again on Saturday, 50 or 60 years on, where the GAA now have sold out to Sky.
So you had to listen to the commentary on RTE instead. You couldn't actually watch the match?
You're absolutely right. I couldn't watch the match because I didn't have Sky, you know. And a lot of people of my age wouldn't have Sky or whatever or be involved with it, that have the normal stations. But there I was, and I couldn't watch the match, and I had to listen to it, as I say, on the radio.
Yeah. And when did you start collecting radios then, the kind of material that's now in the museum? When did you start putting together that collection? Was it all yours, or did some of it come to you from other people?
No, it's generally what's there is mine, that I've collected over 50-odd years. It started for me, really, and not with radio, believe it or not, but going to work one morning in West Kensington and going out to get a train. And there was loads of records, the 78 records, thrown out for the bin man. And I didn't know what this was all about. And then I realised vinyl had just come in. So people were dumping the 78 records. And where I came from down the west of Ireland, the records were very badly worn, because you couldn't get needles during the war. So people made their own type of needles and with nails and whatever, and damaged all the records. So these was all these beautiful records thrown out for the dustman in the morning, and I thought to myself, my God, if we had these in the west of Ireland, we'd make great use of them. So I started to pick up some of them. And interesting things like the Hitler, maybe, and Lloyd George and Eisenhower and people like that, their voices recorded on radio, and people were dumping them out, the King's Speech and stuff like that. And I started to pick up some of the records, and that started me off. And then I got a gramophone, I bought a gramophone and started to play the record on it, and that got me hooked. And then into radio, of course, and radio accessories and Morse and Morse keys and crystal sets, early radios. The more I collected, the more I read about them. And then I got into the history of them, and one thing led to another, and one item leads to another. When you read, you have microphones and you have different things that connected with broadcasting and transmission, and you realize the difference between transmission and broadcasting and how it all come about and the part Ireland played in it all, and it really got me hooked.
Can you remember what was your first radio?
I can, believe it or not. The first radio that came into our house in England, when I say our house, it didn't come into my house, believe it or not. The first one came into my late wife. We're going out at the time, and she lived in Shepherd's Bush, and I lived in Kensington. And she got a little bush, she got a tax rebate or something, and got a little bush radio, and that's the first radio in the collection. I always blame, I used to blame her for it. I said, you got me going collecting. But, you know, that started me off, I suppose.
And what's the history then of the radio museum itself, and how did you establish that? When did you establish it, and how did you do it?
Well, it came about by chance, I suppose. In 2002, my late wife died, and I was after retiring, and it was almost my ambition to open up a museum or whatever. And it was finding a suitable place and that, and my wife not being well. But in any case, after she died, I was at loose ends, and I was looking around for somewhere to start up a museum or whatever. And I met up with a man from Fingal County Council, whom they were out in Malahide Castle at the time, and they were operating out of there doing some work or whatever. And anyway, he put me in touch with another gentleman in Fingal to see if they'd have a premises. I knew the history in Howth, but I didn't think I could get into the Martella Tower or whatever. But in any case, when I told him what I was about and whatever, he said to leave it with him, and that the Martello Tower had been refurbished in Howth and that it was lying idle. So we took it up from there, and he sent somebody out to inspect my collection or whatever, and eventually I got into the tower there. And of course, all the history of communications in Ireland started off in the tower. It was the ideal location, apart from the beautiful view from it and whatever. And it dates back to 1852. Now, I didn't know that at the time, but I knew about Marconi having a station there in 1905. And Lee Forrest, the American scientist, he did a transmission from there in 1903. And then I was one morning in town, really, this was years earlier, and picking up bits of radio in the Cumberland Street in Old Market, and I picked up a copy of the Dublin Penny Journal from January 1904, and it told the story of an American inventor who came to, at the behest of the British Post Office, who came to Howth, was invited to Howth in 1903 in competition with Marconi, and to do a transmission. And he did, across the Holyhead in Wales, and very successfully. In fact, he had a faster system than Marconi, and Marconi was getting established at the time as well. It was long before the days of broadcasting as we know it. So he did very successfully. He was very successful there, but unfortunately for him, he was only brought as a test piece, if you like, to compare him to Marconi, because most of the hierarchy in England and particularly that of the young members of Parliament and the House, members of Parliament and the House of Commons, had bought the Marconi shares. So they couldn't very well, after inviting them over, they couldn't very well give them a contract because of their support for Marconi and buying the shares and whatever. And of course, there was another factor in that as well, in that Marconi was very well connected in London, because a lot of people might not realise, but his mother was Irish, and she was Annie Jimison of the Whiskey family. She was his mother, and as a young woman went to Italy to train as an opera singer, and that's where she met Marconi.
So to come back then to the founding of the museum, your collection was inspected. The council inspected your collection, and what happened then?
Well, they gave me permission initially for a month, but I couldn't take that on for a month because it would have cost too much to set it up. So we come to an agreement anyway that they would let me have it as long as I needed it, because they owned it and it was lying idle. There was more history in the tower than I brought to it, because, believe it or not, it was the birth of communications in Ireland, if you like, before the first cable came in there. In the second cable, it was the second underwater cable in the world. The first came from Calais in France to Dover, and that was the second one, from Holyhead across to the Martello Tower in Howth. And it connected us up with Europe for the first time with Morse. Before that, the quickest communication was by mail boat or by pigeon service. So it actually took over from the pigeon, if you like, and it brought us into the modern era. And the cable was laid, came in there, and believe it or not, before the Crimean War, it was reported in Dublin, it had to come through Howth, it came to Howth first, and then on to Dublin.
And to come back to the museum in Howth, there's an amazing collection of radiograms and valve radios, transistor radios, even crystal sets. What would be your favourite of all of the...
There isn't any radiograms in it. It's the one thing I haven't got and the room for them. But I have all sorts of radios, floor model radios and table model radios and transistor radios and crystal radios and whatever. My favourite radio, you should say, would have to be a Pilot I have up there, an American Pilot from about 1935. And I had it in my bedroom here, and my wife used to be sick of listening to it, I think. And I could pick up stations from all over Europe on it without an aerial, without an outdoor aerial. There was an indoor aerial built in it. And I could pick up stations from all around Europe, all hours of the night, including the American forces and network in Europe and whatever. And you had preachermen and politicians and all sorts of people preaching at night, all hours of the night on it. And that, I have happy memories of that.
And is there a station that you listened to a lot over the years? I mean, you were in England for quite a while. You listened to Radio Éireann from home. Were there other stations that influenced you down the years that you liked listening to?
Oh, yeah. I think I suppose everybody of my era listened to Radio Luxembourg. And Hilversum was a famous one. And believe it or not, and don't ask me why, I don't know. But I get people in, as you know, from all over the world. But people from mostly from around Europe, the first station they mention is Hilversum. Mm. And they needn't be from Holland. It could be from Germany, it could be from France or anywhere. And they've all listened to Hilversum radio for some unknown reason. Mm-hmm. And most of couldn't tell me why, but it was like listening to Radio Luxembourg. Mm-hmm. You know, but I'd be a great Radio Éireann listener. Or 2RN, as it was known in 1926 when it was formed. It was then 2RN, and then became Radio Éireann. I grew up with Radio Éireann and Athlone and whatever. The shortwave station was in Athlone, 32. So, yeah. But I listened to Lyric a lot as well, and I was mostly Lyric and Radio Éireann now, BBC.
What period were you living in England? What were the years?
I went to England in 54, 53, in fact, October 53, and I stayed there until 73.
Wow, that was really the golden age of radio then in England. Your radio dial must have been absolutely buzzing with such a variety of stations at that time.
You had a marvellous selection, and a marvellous selection of music and everything, you know, from all over Europe, I might add. It was the great days of radio, you know, probably. And the thing was, I suppose, growing up in my era, you actually, as well as listening to it, like the Match from America, you formed the pictures in your imagination. I read one time in a magazine that it was a theatre of the mind, radio, where you actually listened and then you formed your own pictures in your imagination. Like when you'd hear a kick of the ball, you'd just think you could imagine the fella kicking it on the radio or whatever, you know. And you had a great programme at the time on the radio, Take the Floor, Danger, was the fella presenting it. And you'd hear all the dancing and the tapping on the floor and whatever, and you could just imagine it all in your imagination. You could sit back, you had nothing to distract you. There was nothing to focus on. Only you imagined it all.
And is that what gives radio its magic still, do you think?
I think it is for my generation. I think probably the younger generation might miss out on that, because they had everything visual when they were growing up. But we didn't have that. And I suppose that's why the artificial light was so important, in that I think youngsters are scared of the dark. And when you went out at night, the whole countryside was in darkness. If it was a cloudy night, you could see nothing. If it was a starry night, you would look up and see all the stars and whatever. But you were generally scared of the dark. We were anyway, I'm sure most youngsters were. So the artificial light meant so much.
And do you think, is radio threatened now then with younger generations, with the proliferation of digital and everything becoming miniature? And I mean, will radio as we knew it, will that survive in the future, do you think?
I think as long as people have ears to listen, I think it will survive. Maybe a different form of it or whatever, you know. Who knows what's out there, you know. But I'm sure in my generation, in my lifetime anyway, people will be listening to it.
Because it's still remarkably popular in Ireland, despite all of the competition. We hear that radio still maintains a strong hold over the public imagination.
Yeah, but it'll be in different forms. You won't have the radio sets as we know them, as we had them. I went into a place in town last Christmas there, and normally the shelves would be stacked with radios and whatever, only about a half a dozen, you know. So that's a sign of the times, where people can pick it up on the internet and whatever, you know.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3.
You're listening to an extended interview with the founder of the Hurdy Gurdy Museum of Vintage Radio in Howth, Pat Herbert. The Martello Tower, where the museum is located, played a pivotal role in the history of broadcasting, not only in Ireland but internationally. Pat went on to explain Marconi's connection with the tower and how it contributed to the development of broadcasting.
Ireland played a pivotal role in the discovery of wireless and radio and whatever. In that, I mentioned earlier about Marconi's mother being Irish, Annie Jimison, from Enniscorthy in Wexford. But when Marconi was a young man growing up, of course, he wasn't deemed bright enough to go to university. And he was lucky enough that they lived near a professor in Italy, in Bologna, Professor Righi, and he was very interested in communications or whatever, and he gave Marconi access to his attic and whatever, where he had his equipment and scientific equipment. And luckily for Marconi, I suppose, he took a great interest in the German scientist Hertz, who had discovered these hidden radio waves in the atmosphere, and hence they became known as Hertzian waves, we might refer to them now as electromagnetic waves or whatever, but they were Hertzian waves, and Marconi started to transmit over short distances across a room, for instance, and ringing a bell and different things. And his mother was very impressed with what he was doing. Nobody else took any notice of him. So she approached the Italian government and hoped that they might take an interest in what he was doing, sponsor him. But they had no interest anyway. There were other ways involved. So she decided to take him to England, where she had some rich cousins in the shape of the Jemison family. Sir Henry Jemison was head of the Jemison Empire in England, and he introduced Marconi anyway to incidentally, the customs confiscated his equipment when he was coming in and took it off him. But in any case, he got it back again. He got introduced to the right people, including Sir William Preece, who was head of communications at the time. And he took Marconi under his wing anyway, and he was impressed with what he was doing. So he got him transmitting over different distances with plenty of equipment. And he was quite successful around Salisbury Plain and places like that, and the Isle of Wight. But in any case, Lloyd's of London, the insurance company that insured ships going to sea, they were very interested in what he was doing. Because when ships went out over the horizon, nobody knew what happened to them. If they came back, they came back. If they didn't, nobody knew. So Lloyd's took a particular interest in this. And they gave Marconi a contract to set up a station in Rathlin Island up off the coast of County Antrim. And another one on the mainland in Ballycastle. So they could be in touch with the ships. They'd put a Marconi apparatus in the ships and have one on the island and the mainland. And they'd be in touch with the ships at all times, which is very important. Marconi duly came to set up the station anyway. And he had a young Dublin engineer working with him there. Edwin Glanville was his name. And he had gone to college to Professor Fitzgerald in Trinity. That's where he qualified. And that time they weren't known as engineers, but by professional electricians. So anyway, he came to set up the station for Marconi in Rathlin. Now the Dublin paper, the Express, and a sister paper, the Evening Mail, they found out about this. So they actually invited Marconi down to Dublin to transmit on boat races, which were the biggest in Europe maybe at the time, and the Kingstown Regatta, which was certainly one of the biggest in the British Empire, biggest sporting event. So Marconi came down to transmit on them anyway, on the boat races. And by a coincidence anyway, after he was on his way to Dublin anyway, or on his way to Dunleary, and met up with the boy from that was up on Rathlin Island, Edwin Glanville, and he told him he was worried that he didn't have a proper inductance coil to use on the boat. So young Edward Glanville told him there was no need to worry, that there was one in Trinity College. Professor Fitzgerald in Trinity College had one, and that was the one they used. And it was actually built, I think, by out in Maynooth by Professor Callan, Nicholas Callan, who had been dead by this time. But ironically, it was his inductance coil they used at the Kingstown Regatta, and it's still on display out in the museum in Maynooth. But in any case, they went out on the boat anyway, and for the longer races they raced from Kingstown into Howth. So Marconi was in a boat opposite the tower, one of the reasons we are there. He was in a boat opposite the tower called the Flying Huntress, with Professor Fitzgerald from Trinity and a few more people on the board. And Edwin Glanville, the young electrician or engineer, he was in the harbour master's office in Kingstown. So as the boats passed the finishing line in Howth, Marconi would write down the results, and then with a telegraph key or a Morse key, he sent a message from there to Kingstown. And Edwin Glanville there then read the message, read the report results, and he then sent them by telephone to Dublin with the results that the results of the races were on the evening paper. Now the people of Howth or Dunleary couldn't see the race because it was a very foggy day, but they could actually read the results in the afternoon, with the result that this became a force and it put Marconi on the map. What he was doing in England and Wales and everywhere else, it didn't get the publicity it may well have got. But because of what happened in Howth, it became the first sporting event in the world transmitted by wireless, and also the first journalistic use of wireless. So all the journalists caught on to this, and it got worldwide acclaim, with the result that Marconi got invited to do the same on the boat races in America. Despite the fact that they had Lee De Forest and Fessenden and different people there that were well capable of doing it, Marconi was invited over, and he did the same over there. So he got worldwide publicity, and this helped people to buy the shares. Everybody then wanted to buy the Marconi shares and whatever. And this is where Sir Henry Jimison came in. He had formed the company. He was a businessman, where Marconi wasn't. Just a young man. So in actual fact, what he did, and this is where the House of Commons came in buying the shares and the Marconi inquiry later and whatever, that put Marconi on the map. So as I say, he went and did the boat races in America and was very active, and he set up a mother station then in Cornwall. But 3 years later, that was 1898, in 1901, early in 1901, he got another contract from Lloyd's to set up a station in Crookhaven, down in County Cork. Now, this, by all intents and purposes, should have caused a lot of problems, because scientists at the time believed it wasn't possible to get over the curvature of the Earth with signals. But Marconi set up a station in Crookhaven, and from Cornwall to Crookhaven, over 130 odd miles, without any difficulty, he got his reception into Crookhaven. And this gave him the incentive, if you like, that to go across the Atlantic and set up a station. Originally he had intended to Cape Cod in America. When he got to Cape Cod, the weather was ferocious and he couldn't get his aerials to stay up. So he decided to go to the nearest place on the mainland to Cornwall, which was Newfoundland. When he got to Newfoundland, the weather was even worse. So he had a lot of problems. But anyway, he had a plan A and a plan B. The plan B was, if he couldn't get aerials, he was to put up a kite. So after several failed attempts with a kite, he got one to go up to 400 feet. And he had pre-arranged times he had arranged for the signal to come in. So at pre-arranged times, they put on the signal from Cornwall. And lo and behold, and they pick it up anyway, with the makeshift aerial. But this makeshift aerial he had was a kite on a wire, and it was blowing furiously in the wind. Now the Morse receiver he had with him, which would normally have picked up the signal if the aerial had been permanent, but it wouldn't pick it up with the aerial flying around. So luckily for him, there was a man on hand that recorded, he could read Morse. And when he had received the signal and all, the scientists said it wasn't possible. because they couldn't get over the curvature of the earth that must have come from a boat nearby. But this guy, Lee Bennett, recorded what happened anyway, which we have in the museum. We have the original record up there. And it tells the story of what happened. And that's regarded as the birth of radio. Not what happened in Dublin, or what happened in England or Wales or whatever. But going across the Atlantic for the first time is regarded as the birth of radio. And everything we have today has come down from that.
Not, of course, as we know it, because the broadcasting, as we understand it, didn't start until the 1920s. Well, it did.
The first broadcast, I believe, that was a transmission, what went over the Atlantic. It was from point A to point B, if you like. But one of the first broadcasts recorded was in 1906, Fessenden, a Canadian, on New Year's night in 1906. He set up a studio and started to broadcast. And I suppose unknown to him, it was picked up by boats and ships along the way, and they couldn't believe it. They heard this violin music, Holy Night, and whatever played on the violin. And that was the birth of broadcasting. Now, officially, that was unofficially. Officially, broadcasting didn't happen until a year later, 1907. And it was our friend again, Lee DeForest, that came to Howth in 1903. He's regarded as the first official broadcast because he set up a broadcasting system in the city of New York and put some speakers around. And from on top of the opera house, he relayed his music and whatever. So that's officially the first broadcast in the world, 1907.
But that was using speakers. It wasn't using medium wave, for instance. It was simply...
I honestly don't know. Yeah. I'd imagine it was. But it's regarded as the first broadcast. Now, when I say the first broadcast by wireless, I might add. There's an earlier broadcast, but it wasn't by wireless. And it happened in Hungary, right? In the 1880s, believe it or not. A man by the name of Puskas, Theodore Puskas was his name. And what he did, he broadcast over wires, if you like, in that he put it into to cinemas or houses or opera houses or whatever, and it could be termed a form of broadcasting, but not by wireless broadcasting as such, by different theatres or whatever, by wires where people could listen.
And the name, of course, of the radio museum, the Hurdy-Gurdy Radio Museum, that was related to a comment by a politician, wasn't it?
I suppose it was, yeah. Most things get down to the politicians. Yeah, the Hurdy-Gurdy, it was by Lemass, Sean Lemass, and he didn't approve. Like, in the early days in Ireland, we had troubled times in Ireland in the 20s, you know. I think that's kind of forgotten, you know, but we had great difficulty even setting up a station or whatever. And Marconi was one of the first in 1923, I think. Yeah, 1923, he got permission to set up a station in Royal Marine Hotel in Dunleary and to broadcast into the RDS to the show. And he duly obliged anyway, and he had speakers in the hedges, hidden in the hedges in there, and were people coming into the show that could get this music. And I think some of it was relayed from the BBC, who were operational at the time, and this didn't go down well with the politicians. And after a couple of days, he was asked to remove. Tim Healy asked him to remove his equipment.
The Governor General,
yeah. And asked him to remove the equipment, which Julie had to do, you know. So everything wasn't straightforward with broadcasting in Ireland, you know.
Yeah.
They ran into all sorts of political problems or whatever, but the name anyway, getting back to the hurdy-gurdy, we had less problems. Le Mas was asked for some financial help in the early days of 2 hours in, and he was a minister anyway, and one of the government, could be in the 30s, I guess, and they were looking for some financial help, so they invited him into Henry Street in Dublin anyway, to the studios. And I suppose when he met the boss man anyway in 2 hours in, he referred to the radio station as a hurdy-gurdy, part wind-up and part wireless, if you like. So he asked him, how was the old hurdy-gurdy going, you know. So that's where the name come from, as far as I was concerned. But then I was speaking to Mrs. Bozang, she's a doctor of music down in Clontarf, and she enlightened me further on it, because she said that in the early days of the orchestra in RTE, I think there was a German conductor there, and the workers referred to all the different sounds of the orchestra as a hurdy-gurdy. So that's where he got the name from, I guess.
You must get a lot of questions about it from visitors, why the hurdy-gurdy music.
Yes, I do, and people don't realise that it was an old Irish musical instrument. Going back again to Dr. Bozang, she wrote the history of Irish music, I think, from the 1700s. And down in Cork in the late 1700s, I think, or early 1800s, believe it or not, there was I think it was 3 music shops in Cork, and one guy in there, he boasted that he could play the 3 instruments he had that he sold. One of them was the hurdy-gurdy, obviously, and the other one, I was amazed, was the guitar, and the other one was the piano, you know. And there were the 3 instruments, and he could play them, but the hurdy-gurdy was still obviously being sold at that time in Ireland.
And to come back to the museum in Howth then, what would you like to see happening to that in the future, or what are your plans for that?
Well, I'd love to see it being kept going. My son tells me he'll keep it going, but it's not easy, because you have to have a love for this, and you have to put your time into it and whatever, you know. I'm lucky at the moment, I have a bit of help there from Foss, and they're supplying me with a couple of guys to run it. You know, because in my state of health and my time of life, I can't give it the attention I'd like to give it. And we have a few volunteers there as well. But who knows? But I'd certainly love to see it kept going, and in that particular spot, because of the history there. And we get people from all around the world there and come to visit it and see it now on the internet and whatever. And but who knows whether it has a future or not, I really don't know.
And we hope also that the museum will continue and prosper into the future. I visited the tower recently, and I think it's safe to say that if you're any way at all interested in radio, it's absolutely fascinating, both in terms of the technology and in terms of radio's history and social and cultural impact. The museum's website is hurdygurdyradiomuseum.wordpress.com, and until October, it's open daily from 11 a.m. until 4 p.m. They also have a lively Twitter account at Hurdy Gurdy Radio. I'd like to thank Pat Herbert for taking the time to talk to us on Wireless, and to wish him the very best for the future. And that brings us to the end of the first edition of Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Thanks to Paula Healy for her technical assistance with the programme. We'll be back on the first Monday in October. As the Dublin station TXFM is due to close in October, we'll be focusing on the future of alternative music radio in Ireland in the next show. I do hope you'll join us then, but in the meantime, don't forget to follow us on Twitter at WirelessFlirt and on Facebook.com/WirelessFlirt. Until the next edition of Wireless, this is John Walsh wishing you good listening.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3.